Hi, everyone. Welcome to Evoke Therapy Program's broadcast. Today, we have a special guest, Dr. Julie Hanks. Dr. Hanks is a licensed clinical social worker and psychotherapist with 28 years experience, specializing in women's emotional health and relationships. She's an assistant professor of social work at Utah Valley University. She's also the founder and director of Wasatch Family Therapy, an outpatient therapy clinic in Salt Lake City, Utah, and Bountiful, Utah. She's the author of The Burnout Cure and The Assertiveness Guide for Women. She's a blogger. She's a local and national media contributor and an online influencer and a private practice consultant. She's an award-winning songwriter. A native Californian, Dr. Hanks currently lives in Sandy, Utah, and I'm really pleased to have her today. So thank you, Dr. Hanks. I'm so glad that you're joining us today. I'm so glad to have you as a guest on our podcast.
Thank you. My pleasure, Dr. Reedy.
Can you tell our audience a little bit about the journey, what kind of led to the work that you're doing, how you became a therapist, what brought you into this work?
Yes, I went to therapy as an adolescent, about 14 years old. My parents were wise enough to say, "We don't know how to help you." And so I started seeing a therapist in my mid-teens, and that was life-changing for me. It opened up this world of intangibles, of thoughts, feelings, of relational dynamics, and it lit a fire in me to want to do that for other people. So my own therapy was kind of the spark for that, initially becoming a therapist.
I think I read that you grew up in Southern California. Is that right?
That's correct.
Where did you grow up?
I grew up in Studio City area in the San Fernando Valley.
Right. So part of what I've noticed about your work is working in the Utah, the Salt Lake area. You know, there are definitely themes in your work that I think are related to the culture here in the state that you and I live in. Can you talk about the development of your focus, your themes in your work, and how that came about as you developed your practice and your audience?
Sure. So I moved to Utah right after my senior year, and I've stayed here. So my clinical practice has been solely in Utah. And because of that, I have had many, many Latter-day Saint clients, and primarily female clients and couples. I work with men too, but my passion has been helping empower women in conservative religious cultures. And that's been my clinical experience. It's also been my personal experience to try and empower myself in a conservative religious culture. And so that's where it was born. I have a couple of books, and they were both written for women specifically, and women's empowerment.
So tell us the name of your books while we're on that subject.
Yeah, The Burnout Cure is the first one, and that was written specifically for Latter-day Saint women. And then The Assertiveness Guide for Women is a general market self-help book.
I want to get to the part about faith transitions, because that's such a fascinating focus of your work. And I think it's so important for a lot of people, especially for parents, as their children might be going through that process. But before I get to that, what are the challenges, the resistance, the barriers that when you're working with families in conservative religious cultures, what are the kinds of things that you bump up against commonly, and kind of how you navigate that resistance that comes from those messages, those traditions embedded in the culture?
Mm-hmm. When it comes to women specifically, there is an idealization of motherhood as the pinnacle of a woman's existence. And that becomes really tricky when your kids don't, quote unquote, turn out the way you hope. What if they leave the faith, if they make choices that are against your religious beliefs? So that is one of the main barriers, is this overinvestment sometimes in how your children in your children's behavior and how they make you look in your culture. And that's not just women. That happens with men too. But I found that it's particularly difficult for women to separate themselves from their children's behavior.
Do you get a lot of resistance from husband and men where they're kind of pushing against your what probably from their perspective is this radical feminism, I imagine, from their vantage point? Do you get a lot of resistance and pushback? And does that threaten the work that you're doing with wives and women?
I don't get a lot of pushback. There are a lot of great men who support partnership in marriage. I talk a lot about partnership and creating partnership marriages and families. And that's been really well received. Although I do have to say, the people who are often the meanest online tend to be conservative men. So
I apologize for and on behalf of my gender for that.
And that's a total generalization. They're also very delightful too, but I've kind of noticed this little pattern. I don't, you know.
Right. You know, one of the questions I get, Dr. Hanks, when I'm working with a family, maybe LDS or Catholic or from the Jewish faith, it could be from really any context, is I'll be teaching something or presenting something, especially in the realm of parenting. And the response to me is, but some of the ideas go against what we're hearing from the rabbi, what we're hearing from the bishop or the priest at the pulpit. And so how do you, I guess I'm probably cheating here and just asking for any ideas that you have. How do you respond to people who not unkindly, but kind of push back that part of your message, part of your technique, your process kind of in their minds comes into conflict with what they're being taught on Saturdays or Sundays?
Well, how I respond to that is not everything you're taught on Saturdays and Sundays is good for your mental health. And there are core doctrines in religions, and those tend to be very healthy, you know, love other people, serve other people, you know, be honest. Those kind of core teachings are very healthy, but you get into how the culture implements some of these teachings, and that's where we get into trouble. So I like to differentiate between like core teachings and the application of those things in the broader culture.
Because of your population, your focus, do you end up working with a lot of families whose children or loved ones are, I'll get to faith transitions, like I said, in just a moment, but that maybe are identifying in the LGBTQ population and they're struggling with that. Is that something that you encounter a lot in your work in Utah?
Yes, definitely. That is a source of struggle in a lot of families. Where do I put my LGBTQ child? Like, this doesn't fit into my belief system, and how do I navigate this? So it can be really tricky for families.
I imagine. Some of the people listening to this, of course, won't be either LDS or even familiar with LDS culture, with the Latter-day Saint culture. I imagine there are some things about it that generalize to other religions and some of it that don't. Is that true for you? Are there some things that you find unique to this culture, or is it mostly or all kind of, it sounds and looks the same, with the specifics being different, but it sounds and looks the same as other cultures?
Yeah, I think a lot of the problems are probably influenced by larger Western culture, mm-hmm. like the appearance oriented and looking to your children to validate you, and kind of, so I think there are a lot of similarities in conservative religious cultures, although of course there are differences in how those manifest. But something unique about Utah is that there are so many Latter-day Saints living in close proximity. Mm-hmm. So the proximity creates its own interesting dynamics. And you'll find that in any community that's homogenous, there'll be different dynamics that emerge because of the similarities.
So there becomes this kind of, I've seen it in parts of New York, there becomes this kind of cultural overlay, which almost overtakes the religion and kind of substitutes for the religion that you have in these kinds of communities. Is that what you're talking about?
Yes, exactly.
I wanted to talk about faith transitions because that's something that I'm sure some of our audience have experienced, either firsthand or a loved one. Could you share with us some of your insights, some of your ideas, maybe even tools around how to navigate it if you're the one going through the process, any kind of support you can give to that person. But then the second part of that would be the family members, maybe even specifically the parents. If your child decides to opt out, to change from the family's idea of what's, you know, what the family's religion is, what insights do you have for the individual or the family member during a faith transition?
Yeah, for the individual, I often try to frame the transition as growth, as a positive thing. And it doesn't necessarily mean you're going to leave the faith, although that sometimes happens, but it's part of development, human development, to continue growing, asking questions, and really claiming control control over your own life and not living your life to please other people. So I look at it as a developmental process and as a positive thing with the individual, even though it's really painful. And there's a lot of fear of disappointing people, disappointing your parents. One of my frequent sayings is part of being a grown-up is disappointing your parents. Yeah. Because you're living your life and not their life. And so I try to encourage people to tolerate disagreement and disappointment. Like, it's okay. It's okay. And then for the family members, for parents in particular, I would say don't make your child or adult child's faith transition about you and your failure as a parent. It actually could be a sign that you were a successful parent and that your child has some autonomy and a sense of mastery over their own life. So that can be a really good thing. It's not about you're a bad parent.
Right. You kind of stole my next question. I love that quote that I saw from you about, you know, part of growing up is learning to disappoint your parents. I absolutely love that.
Thank you.
I think it's important for parents to hear you say that out loud as they kind of operate in their role as a parent also. I'm going to read a couple of things to you that you've written.
Okay.
Kind of get your reaction to them.
Great.
I love this idea that you talk about. If you're a parent who has left the church, you don't have to defend your parenting skills to anybody. Can you expand on that and tell us a little bit about that idea?
Yes. So adults who are transitioning from their faith tradition often get criticism like, you know, now you're a bad parent now, you're not teaching your children the faith. And so it kind of goes back to that autonomy and that differentiation of self, that you don't have to justify your decisions or your parenting or any of your choices to anyone else. And that's another benefit of being an adult.
Mm-hmm. I love it. You talk about that a lot with the education you have around boundaries, about being able to not justify yourself, being the boundary coming from a place of authentic truth is enough. And I don't think most of us were raised in homes where that was good enough. We kind of had to prove ourselves and defend our position even as children, which is probably why we lean toward that behavior as adults.
Yes, definitely. It's hard for people to just say no.
Right.
I'm not gonna do that. You feel like you need to often give an excuse or a reason or justify. And we can just set a boundary and then be done with the conversation.
I read a quote about from you that actually challenged me personally, not clinically, theoretically. I probably agree with it on that level, but I struggle with it personally. And so I'm going to share it with you and kind of get your perspective on it. And again, ask you to expand on it. But it's a quote recently where you posted, "We don't have to be exactly alike to be friends." Mm-hmm. I think with what's going on and the divisiveness in our culture these days, in our politics, in our society, and the discourse that's going on, I find it personally more and more difficult to navigate that, to find a way to be connected, to stay connected, to socialize with people. Obviously, the pandemic is making socialization activities a little bit different, but can you talk about and expand on that idea of not having to be exactly alike to be friends, and how you navigate that yourself, and how you encourage or coach that with clients?
When we are having difficulty tolerating someone else's differences, it's often a sign of an area that's immature in us. If we're immature, we need other people to mirror the sameness to us to validate ourselves.
Right.
And so you can look at this as it's actually a good exercise in maturity to be able to tolerate different points of view. And instead of feeling threatened, to become curious. And curiosity is one of the best skills you can develop when it comes to navigating differences with friends or family members or loved ones. Just getting curious, where are they coming from? What is the world like from their point of view? And that makes a difficult conversation so much easier, because you're not having to defend anything. You're just getting curious about where they're coming from. And people love to talk about what they think. And so most people will go on and on about it, and you get to learn more about that loved one or that friend.
Well, I was kind of hoping that the answer to the question didn't lead to me having to own my own immaturity, but I do agree with you and do appreciate it.
And I'm not always good at this. Trust me.
There's at least one point in every episode of my podcast where my emotional immaturity is exposed. So I appreciate you getting that on the table as soon as possible. Another idea, again, that I would love for you to expand upon, another quote of yours, that I think about half of our audience is parents and parents of struggling children, struggling with mental health or addiction issues. So there's a lot of parenting themes in our work on our podcasts. There's a quote from you, from yours that says, "If you struggle to embrace motherhood, it may be that your mother didn't meet your childhood needs." I find that parents struggle so much to see the connection between the challenges in parenting and the undealt with, the unprocessed wounding from their own childhood. So again, can you speak to that idea about how to make that connection, how to travel back and understand and see the connection between the challenges you might be having as a mother or father and your own childhood wounding, your own unmet needs?
Yes. Gosh, we could do a whole podcast episode on this topic, because
right.
I've been thinking a lot about it. But Dr. Jeffrey Young identified 5 core childhood needs. And I think these are really great and helpful. One is the freedom to express emotion. 2 is secure relationships and a sense of belonging. 3 is autonomy and a sense of unique identity. 4 is realistic expectations. And 5 is play and spontaneity. And so as your listeners are hearing this list, if there's something that you didn't get growing up, it's likely impacting your relationships now. And I find that my unmet needs crop up or a sign that they're kind of creeping in is resentment about my children's needs. When I feel resentful that they have needs, I'm like, okay, this is probably an unmet need of mine, and how can I meet it now as an adult? How can I be the parent that I needed? And my parents were great, but we just all have unmet needs, right? We don't have perfect parents. So notice resentment creeping in. Notice if one child tends to trigger intense emotions more than another child. Those are some signs that you might need to look deeper at yourself.
You're such an articulate speaker. You're a writer, obviously. Can you talk a little bit about like the clinical work you do, the one-on-one work that you do with clients versus the teaching, and kind of what are the differences? What are the differences in your role when you're teaching and talking like this or writing versus when you're sitting in a therapy session with a couple or an individual who's struggling or suffering? How do you, what is each of those tasks, how do they require different aspects of you?
Yeah, interesting question, because I am not currently seeing therapy clients. I run my therapy clinic, Wasatch Family Therapy, but I teach, write, do media, social media, and I'm also a professor of social work at Utah Valley University. Mm-hmm. And so I'm not doing clinical work, although I am doing coaching. Mm. So the reason, several years ago, I just felt like I needed to take my energy that I was putting into my clinical work and put it elsewhere to reach more people. Mm-hmm. And then I missed the clinical work. So I decided to do just some coaching on the side, and that's kind of expanded. Right. So coaching is closer to teaching, right, than therapy is. Mm-hmm. My therapeutic approach when I was seeing clients tends to be attachment based, using the relationship, you know, with me as a therapist to kind of heal unmet needs. I tend to have a more psychodynamic perspective, even though I'm eclectic in terms of interventions. I use, you know, CBT and ACT and all the acronyms. Right. But I believe that our early childhood relationships impact our current difficulties. Mm-hmm. And healing those original wounds, the initial wounds or unmet needs, can really free us in the present to create the future that we want. So that's kind of my philosophy with therapy. Coaching is a lot more problem solving, focused on the here and now, very, you know, concrete homework assignments and those kind of things. So I'm kind of leaning more toward teaching these days than therapy, like I mentioned.
Yeah. And I'm glad that I was going to ask you about the difference between your view on the difference between coaching and therapy. So that's really helpful.
I think of coaching as supplements and therapy as medication.
Hmm. Well, that's a great perspective. I can understand why I was so drawn to your work, because so much of what you talk about and teach, we share a very, very similar lens. I want to give you a chance. I want to give the listeners a chance for you to speak directly, specifically to women and to mothers. So many of the parents that we work with at Evoke, the women more than the men are feeling just tremendous guilt. You know, their identity is so wrapped up in the child's success. It's part of what culture teaches and reinforces, is that the woman's report card is how her child is doing or how her children are doing. So I would just want to give you a chance to speak to that mother who is beating herself up for the struggles that the child has, and even how maybe some of her own imperfections relate to that, right? There are mistakes that every parent makes, and how would you soothe or encourage a mother struggling with that kind of heavy, burdensome guilt?
First, I would empathize and say, I've been there as a parent. Mm-hmm. I've been there. I have two adult children and two teens right now. And one of my kids went through a really, really, really rough rebellious time. And so I've been through that process as a parent. What I learned is that it's not about me. It's about my child's development and growth. And the less I make it about me, the more I can support them. And so that's something that I think is really important. Also, I would encourage mothers, especially I ask moms a lot, what would you do if you weren't worrying about your child? How would you spend your time?
Right.
Okay, go do that thing. Start building a life that's not revolving around this child or their difficulty or their challenge or their bad behavior, addiction, whatever it is. And really shore up your own sense of worth outside of your child's behavior. Do the things that interest you. Do something that you love every day and take care of yourself. So I think that's really key, is to continue to develop your sense of self as an individual separate from your child.
It's so fascinating because you do, when you're talking and teaching, you do such a great job with parents and children, mothers and children. You do such a great job of encouraging individuation, right? You talk mm-hmm. a lot about not living up, being okay with disappointing your parents, being okay with hurting your parents' feelings, not being responsible for their feelings. And yet you live in and come from a culture and obviously have a lot of values around family togetherness. And so a lot of people, I think, would be confused by that, Dr. Hanks. Like, how do you hold both? How do you hold the idea that you can very much support the individuation process, but you have such a strong, I would say, value for the family? How do you do both at the same time?
Yeah. So there is a myth that close families mean enmeshment. Means lack of boundaries. Everybody's in everyone's business. People feel responsible for each other's problems. That's actually not healthy family relationships. In the healthiest family relationships, there's a high level of differentiation of self. So members of the family are able to be different and still remain connected and in close contact with each other. And so it's kind of counterintuitive, right? You think, wait, if we're different, then we'll be distant. And that's actually not true. The more you are an authentic self, the more intimacy you can cultivate with other people. And so getting rid of that myth that closeness is enmeshment and being intertwined in every part of each other's lives, that's a myth. And differentiation is actually the goal and the path to intimacy.
You wrote this one thing that reminds me of what you're saying right now that I think is not only true and resonates, but I love when good writing also sounds poetic. And you had this nice quote that says, I am learning to love the sound of my feet walking away from the things not meant for me.
Mm.
I think it's a real... Your strength, your gift to your clients is giving and empowering them to be themselves and to choose what to keep and what not to keep in their life and to let go of the guilt that comes when they have to do that is a real, real gift to the people that listen to you, that read you, that have had contact with you, I imagine.
Thank you. Thank you. I appreciate that. Yeah, life is about kind of sorting through what we inherited, what we value, sorting through relationships and leaving the parts of ourselves and the relationships behind that don't work for us anymore and continuing to grow.
And again, as you speak to the folks that might be struggling with another issue, which is a lot, you talk about bishops because you work predominantly in the Latter-day Saint culture, but it's true of clergy members everywhere. What would you say to that individual who is hearing from their clergy member that the problems that they're having, the difficulty, the struggle, the pain that they're experiencing is a spiritual issue instead of a mental health issue? How would you empower or speak to that person who's wearing that like a great burden around their neck?
Yeah, I would say humans are a lot more complex than simple. And to say that a problem is only in one realm, only in the spiritual realm is probably not accurate, because we have all of the parts of us overlap. Too often religious clients and religious leaders will frame things as spiritual when they are mental health problems. They're chemical. They could be related to abuse. They could be related to dysfunctional relationships. So I like to encourage clergy to really recognize their limitations as provider of mental health therapy or counsel or relationship therapy or counseling, and to kind of stick with the spiritual aspect, and not to frame every problem that your congregation members have as just a spiritual problem.
Yeah, I imagine it's fairly appealing to kind of simplify it down to that level, but it does alienate so many people who are struggling with mental health issues and unresolved trauma. So I think, again, just thanks for what you give to the community. Thanks for all that you offer.
Thank you.
I like to ask professionals that I have on the podcast about how they navigate their own self-care, what they do to make sure, because there's so much of this work where you're carrying people's pain, you know, whether it be the DMs that you get, or if you're doing individual therapy or coaching, it happens there. What do you do? How do you manage your self-care?
Yeah, in regards to taking on other people's emotions, I have learned through the decades not to take it on. That if I take on and absorb other people's emotions, I'm actually sending a message that I don't trust them to manage their own life. And so while I can empathize and I can sit with people, I don't take it on anymore. And that's part of my self-care, is figuring out how to do that. And then just general self-care, I practice radical self-care. I get 10 hours of sleep a night. I exercise every morning. I try to eat healthy. I prioritize my relationships. I make time for friendships. I do things every day that I want to do, not just the have-tos. And I have figured out a way to do all the things that I love to do. So I think that's the biggest thing, is I had parents who modeled that for me, like do what you love and figure out how to make a living doing it. And I've been able to do that. And that's probably one of the biggest self-care, is, you know, following my passions and trying to improve people's lives. That's my passion. And so I'm able to do that on a lot of different levels. And that energizes me instead of drains me.
It reminds me of something you wrote where you talk about, if you don't include yourself in your care, you know, if you don't care for yourself, you'll end up looking to your child to meet your needs. And I find so many parents, in their aspiration to be selfless, end up taking and stealing from the people around them without even being aware of it. So it makes sense what you're describing for yourself.
Yes, I try to live that. I hope that my kids don't worry about me or think that they need to do something for me. I try to be not self-sufficient, but interconnected with them, but not have them take on my emotional needs. So right. I try to make sure my needs are met.
Well, again, I thank you. I think I mentioned to you as we were chatting before, you're the first guest that I've had on that I didn't know before the interview. So I was a little bit nervous then.
Well, I'm honored.
Before we wrap up, I want to give you a chance to tell our audience where to look for you, where to find resources, any of the resources for your work that they can find.
Yes. WasatchFamilyTherapy.com is my therapy clinic in Utah. And drjuliehanks.com, drjuliehanks, is the place where you can go to read my blog articles, get coaching, to get online courses, and then at drjuliehanks on social media, and particularly Instagram is kind of where I have do a lot of interaction, Q&As, and things like that. So connect with me on Instagram.
Dr. Julie Hanks, thank you so much for being a guest and sharing your passion and your work and your insight with our audience. I really appreciate having you. Really enjoy the discussion and really love the kind of message that you're giving to people.
Thank you so much, Dr. Reedy. I appreciate the invitation. Bye.